All right, since I'm being recorded for posterity, anyone I accidentally insult who hears this on the web, I didn't mean it. Anyone who likes what I say about them, I absolutely did mean it.
Is it a requirement when you get up and start saying that right now?
It's always safest. Okay, Jean-Pierre has requested. Today we're going to talk about time delays and capitalization with the subtitle, Should We Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Big Corona? And big in this case being possibly as large as 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 gravitational radii. So I'll start off with a review of spectral states, so we all sort of on the same wavelength of what I mean by the various different states. And the one that these models are most being applied to is the so-called low/hard state of galactic black hole candidates. I'll define for you how power spectra are done in this business, then I'll talk about the other two measures of variability, time lags and coherence, and then we'll start jumping into the models of time delays. The questions that arise are, can the time delays be made in the disk, or can they be made by a big corona? Could they be waves propagating through the corona, or could they be flares on a disk? And time permitting, hour and a half from now, or hour 45 from now, I'll take a brief look at some very recent RXTE data of GX339-4, Jean-Pierre's favorite system, that shows data that has implications essentially for all of these models, and I'm not sure if the data agrees with any one of them in particular, and maybe end off with a slide giving at least a schematic sketch of what might be going on in the low hard state and the other states. So to set the stage here, here is some old Ginga data of Nova Muscae, otherwise known as GS1124-68. Excuse me?
What is the animal?
Maybe explain something about.
Yes. This is an X-ray nova, which is different from classical nova. This is a galactic black hole candidate. I think its mass function was about 3.5. So its best guess at a mass is about 6. So we're pretty, for this particular case, we're fairly sure that it's a black hole, assuming you don't believe in 6 OMS neutron stars. And the reason I show this one, because it went through all the different classical definitions of states. And so we can show what people mean when they say very high, and low. And this is essentially the order in time that it went through the states. So when it first flared on and was bright, you have this soft thermal bump at about a keV with a power law tail with a photon index, number of photons per square centimeter per second per keV. The photon index was minus 2.5 or so. As it further decayed in luminosity, the tail dropped off and you were left with a nice thermal bump, once again in a keV, no power law tail to speak of. As it further dropped in luminosity, and this was called the very high state, this would be the high state, and then it went to the low/hard state. When it goes below some number, as fractional limiting to luminosity, probably on the order of 5% or so, it goes to a pure power law spectrum with a photon index of about minus 1.7.
What's interesting there is that in the Malou curve, you're lacking even as much power law as you had in these low states.
Yes. Yes, there's a very qualitative difference here that you have a power law which is soft. I should also mention, when people look at these soft power laws in very high state and try to find out where the cutoff is, they can't find one. These power laws extend out to 200 to possibly as far as 500 keV without a break, whereas in the low state, when there is a power law, it breaks at about 100 keV. And as you know, notice here, that the power law really does disappear in between those two.
So out here at the 30 keV range, you're distinguishing between the slope of the green line and the slope of the brown line.
Yeah, it's a little hard to see in this particular slide, but this softens during the decay and then disappears into this. So this, as I said, this is very high, low, and just to sketch that a little bit more schematically for you.
So the hard X, the 30 keV X-rays actually increased in intensity
Yes.
You went from the blue to the green.
Yes.
Which was a time sequence.
That was a time sequence. So yeah, the hard X-rays, the overall bolometric luminosity is dropping, but the hard X-rays are popping up. And schematically,
as I said, this is just repeating what I said: low, high, very high, quasi-thermal bump, typically about a keV. Power law 2.5, no cutoff really seen. On the low state, you do see the cutoff around 100. And here are some various examples of that. Cygnus X1 is typically in this state. GX339-4 is often in this state. As far as these high states, GX339-4 has shown this nice high state with no power law. Nova Muscae went through a period of that. I have another example, V1408 Killy, which I'll be talking about tomorrow, which might be a neutron star, also shows this kind of state. This sort of very high state behavior, shown by Nova Muscae, GX339-4 did it once in 1989, I believe it was. Nova Muscae did it. LMCX1, LMCX3, which are two persistent galactic black hole candidates, tend to show sort of very high state behavior where they have this quasi-thermal component, but these two sources often have steeper power laws than this 2.5. They're galactic black hole candidates, but they're in the large magic Lambda Cal. So yeah, they are extragalactic at 50 kiloparsecs. Their power law tails, 2.5 is about as hard as that ever gets. They can drop off to maybe even -4. And they do show some behavior where the power law is going up and down.
And what's
Cygnus X1? In its soft state, I'll show some data on that in a little bit. It doesn't fit neatly into any of these categories, Cygnus X1 in a soft state. In the sense that when Cygnus X1 transits to the so-called high state, in terms of this classical analogy, Cygnus X1 is the worst example of a high state. What Cygnus X1 does in the high state is that it does have a quasi-thermal bump, but instead of being at 1 keV, it's at 300 eV. It does have a power law tail as well, also 2.5. It's not clear whether in the progression of luminosity the high state of Cygnus X1 is up here or really somewhere in between low and high, in the sense that it's a transition from this power law to something more quasi-thermal. It's fairly different from either one of these two. As I said, it has a lower temperature and a more prominent tail, and also the variability looks a bit different. And we'll show some data from that.
So, Mike, are you saying that although Nova Muscae showed the progression through all three of these states, a given object may not do that?
A given LMCX1, LMCX3 is always in a state like this. The tail goes up and down a little bit. The quasi-thermal bump doesn't do it much. Cygnus X1, 90% of its time is down here. And then there are some things like GRS-1915 and GRJ-1655, which show much, much more complicated behavior. Think of Nova Muscae as sort of the rule by which all the exceptions are defined. Nova Muscae really is the sort of the cleanest example of these classical differences.
Yeah, when it jumps up to the high state from the low state,
Nova Muscae only goes down in luminosity. So it's a transient system. Yeah, it goes down in luminosity. This is the higher luminosity, but progression of time is this direction for Nova Muscae.
But, I mean, does it just suddenly flare to the high state? It doesn't cycle through, to the very high.
Starts in the very high and then goes and decays into the high. It's a fairly rapid change from very high to high.
It doesn't go both.
GX 339-4 goes all directions.
Oh, I see.
But that's not exactly a transient system. Just to get you an idea of what things are in terms of Eddington luminosity, if I quote numbers later, when you do fit these disk black body models, the fit parameters are a radius and a temperature. A temperature of 1 keV and a radius of about 10 kilometers is about 10% Eddington luminosity for a solar mass. So that should give you an idea of how to normalize things. But don't necessarily take those fits as being literal truth. All right, here are the models that are proposed for at least the hard state spectrum. And as I said, that's going to be most of the discussion today is about the hard state spectrum, and they come in a few different varieties. There is the concept that you have a disk with flares going off on the disk. Won't talk too much about this model. The other idea is that you could have a spherical corona. The disk comes in to some radius and then makes a transition to a different sort of state where this is thin, cold, and optically thick. This is optically thinnish, geometrically thick, and fairly hot, on the order of 100 keV. And in the spherical corona models, typically the seed photons for continentization are being invoked as soft photons coming from the outer disk. So one of the questions that we're going to be talking about is, what is the radius of this transition? Similar geometry to this is the ADAF models. You have the same geometry, but in those models, you add in the dynamics to the system. So these really are mostly just spectral models. And they often also invoke for seed photons, cyclosynchrotron photons in the ADAF for seed photons for the continentization. So once again, the question that we're trying to answer is, what is the radius of that, if that is indeed the correct model? So I
see the difference between the spherical and the advection observationally is that the seed photons are produced in the ADAF as opposed to being produced in the disk.
ADAFs also precede photons from the outer disk, but a lot of them also use this as a very important source of seed photons. And to be fair, these models can put that in. The reason why they mostly don't is because once you put in a magnetic field and put in cyclotron seed photons, it's no longer a scale invariant problem. In the sense that if it's just a corona and a disk, you can define a compactness, a dimensionless compactness parameter for the corona, and dimensionless compactness parameter for the disk, and it doesn't matter what size the system, absolute size the system is. You can just do scale the spectrum, and so there's an overall normalization. Once you put the magnetic field in, you've broken the scale of the problem. The scale. Which model?
On the right. No, this is right.
Yes. Yeah, it might.
It
very well might be like this. Yeah.
If not, then it should be rejected.
Most flexible.
Yeah, it is most flexible.
Yeah.
And like I said, we'll talk about all these variability mechanisms, flares, possibility of waves traveling through the coronal region. So here's my adaptation of a figure by Narayan. You might remember this from the conference where he was saying, what is the coronal radius as a function of luminosity? And here I've defined it as the Shapiro-Sanyaev efficiency, 10% times n dot c squared divided by L Eddington, and the coronal radius divided by the gravitational radius, and taking a log graph. Now, to answer Peter's question from last week, where does Shapiro-Sanyaev live? Well, if anywhere the classic Shapiro-Sanyaev disk lives, it's just in this little narrow region here, right at the high state, and nowhere else, really, on the order of 5% Eddington luminosity. The question, pardon? More or less it is. More or less it is. And the question is, what happens as we go to lower luminosity? If it's an efficient corona, it's a possibility that the coronal size goes up to on the order of 100, maybe, g over c squared, and it's not clear whether the size is positively or negatively correlate with radius, or if it really even changes all that much. It's a function of luminosity. ADAF models, as you drop the luminosity, you can push the transition radius further out. So it's quite possible the ADAF models, to have in the ADAF models the coronal radius to grow to fairly large radius, up to the order of 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5. And of course, this is m dot. If I actually do observe luminosity, because the efficiency is also dropping as I change the transition radius, it's a somewhat sharper slope. A different model, which I'll talk about a little bit later, is the Kazanis-Wanta-Tarchuk model, which puts forth the idea that in this transition from high to low, you push the coronal radius all the way out to 10 to the 4, g over c squared. And it's not clear exactly what direction that coronal radius is going as you change luminosities.
The Doppler-Compton model?
The Doppler-Compton model?
Bulk-Compton?
No, this down here would not be bulk-Comptonization. This is a static current. Up here, yeah, you might transit from a to a a corona with bulk quantization going on. And of course, it's, as you go to the hot, very high state, it's not entirely clear what's going on with corona. It's probably a qualitatively different corona because here, down here we see cutoffs in the spectrum. Up here we don't see cutoffs in the spectrum. You know, these are power laws all the way out to 500 keV. Energetically, there's nothing wrong with that because they're 2.5 index or softer. And I'll show you some timing data later that makes this look like it's qualitatively different. So another question is not only what is this transition radius, is it unique for all systems or is it path dependent depending upon where you start off in this and how you transit through this plane? And lest we forget, there are other models that are completely different where this idea of what the coronal radius is not even particularly well defined. There's a model by Belo-Borodov where it's a disk all the way throughout and there are flares going off on the disk. And the reason why in these low states you have weak reflection features and weak iron lines is because that the flares are moving away from the disk relativistically, so they're beamed away from the disk. That's one possible model. Julian Kerlich has suggested that you have an optically thin medium in here and you have blobs moving through that optically thin medium, and that's a somewhat qualitatively different model. And drawn the tesseract here because I think that's quite appropriate for Chris Thompson, where he's proposed a model, and he's never actually written it up yet, and I've got to sort of talk him into doing this one day, that where he suggested that you have a thin disk where the radiative transport is not by radiative diffusion, but it's done by alphane waves advecting energy towards the surface, and you're not comprimizing off of thermal electrons, you're comprimizing off of MHD turbulence. And you can actually get a 1.7 power law in the disk. And so it's scattering off of MHD turbulence, and it's a thin disk throughout. And it also has the cute effect that the temperature rises as a function of height in the disk. And it also does make a transition to a high state as you go to higher luminosity. But that's a completely, completely different model from any of these. So I'll talk about the possible radius of the corona, but just keep in the back of your mind, it could be something completely different. Now, why do we even talk about these spheric coronas? The basic answer is that they actually fit fairly well. And here is a non-simultaneous observation sort of cobbled together from a bunch of different instruments, BBXRT, TTM, HEXI, OSSI, covering from 0.5 kV to 1,000 kV, unfolded from the detector response. You see, this is the low state of Cygnus X1. You have that nice power law. This is neutral hydrogen cutoff down here, with the cutoff at around 100 keV or so. And this basic model where you have a disk outside, soft photons being counted up scattered in a corona. Here the optical depth is 1.4, temperature is 90 keV. Overall, fits the shape very well. And so that's really the motivation for these models. And also, here's a color intensity plot from XTE data. As you see, is that as the count rate goes up, the color gets softer. As the count rate goes down, the color gets a little bit harder. There's a weak trend to do that. That wouldn't be too surprising in a quantization model. I'll slide it a little further up. The idea being that if I set off add extra seed photons to the corona, I'm going to count and cool it a little bit, so it's going to get a little softer. So if I throw in more seed photons, it'll cool down a little bit softer. Less seed photons, it'll be a little bit hotter. So that all sort of hangs together reasonably well for the basic structure of the corona. And here is an example of GX3 through 9-4 in its low hard state with ASCA data going all the way down to 0.5 kV. The best phenomenological fit to this data is you've got a disk black body at 150 eV. This is what's sort of forcing you to say, aha, maybe the disk is at very large radius outside of the corona because it's a fairly low temperature, with a power law that's about 1.6. That little lump there, that's the iron line in galactic black hole candidates. I can see Peter sort of looking at that. That's...
I was wondering about the two spectra. What do those represent? The two space of
the
object? The very upright two curves, yeah.
No. This is the phenomenological model fit. You fit a thermal component at 150 eV, not 1 kV, fairly weak. Then a parallel with a gamma 1.8 with a break at 3 kV, and then a parallel 1.6. This is what's left over in the residuals around the iron line region. 40 eV equivalent width, completely different from AGN. AGN will have an equivalent width of about 200 eV, and it'll be very broad. You can see that this is essentially detector resolution. So whatever is going on in galactic black hole candidates, it's not making much iron line. And that's another reason for going for this concept. You have a sphere in the middle, disk out here. The disk is subtending about 30% of your sky. So it's not seeing much reflection. It's not making much of an iron line. And because it's outside of the current at large radius, it should also naturally have sort of low temperatures.
I guess you could still say it's cold iron rather than hot iron, because it looks like it's 6.5.
Yeah, it's still cold. Yeah, it still is. I'm not real happy with any of the iron line fits yet to galactic black hole candidates. What you really need is a broadband instrument with good energy, good spectral resolution. You can change the continuum model a bit on this and make them broader and stronger. So it's still an open issue, I think. But it's definitely not like AGN lines. It's not as obvious as AGN lines. This is low hard state. Low hard state. All right, what's the different variability issues concerned here? How does it change? And so, you know, how we actually go about measuring variability. Basically, the most popular methods are Fourier transform methods. You take your light curve, you do a Fourier transform, you square it to get the power spectral density. Most often what you see is a normalization where you divide the Fourier transform by the square of the mean of the light curve. So you get something that's independent of distance to the object. So you get something that's a measure of the power. Given this normalization, the one that's most often used in the literature, if you integrate the PSD over a region in frequency, I get the power in that region, which is equivalent to a sinusoid that fractionally varies by plus or minus the square root of 2 times the square root of the integral. And that's called the RMS variability. And typically that can range from 3% to 40% for galactic black hole candidates. And I'll show you a sort of schematic sketch of what that looks like in the different states. Low, high, and very high. Once again, this is sort of the order of luminosity. Low state's the most variable. Typically what you see is flat in the power spectrum up until about 0.1 or so hertz, then rolls off to an f to the minus 1. Power spectrum, and then around up here someplace, 10-ish hertz, it breaks to maybe an f to the minus 2 or so. Total variability on the order of 30-40% RMS variability. High state, when we drop away that power law tail, the variability also disappears entirely with it. The few times it's been observed, you get a very weak f to the minus 0.7 power law. Total variability, 3% or so. In fact, if you come to the talk tomorrow I'm doing, I'll show you what looks like a high state spectrum with a PSD that is flat up to about 10 to the minus 2 hertz and drops like a rock above that. Not a lot of observations. They're fairly hard to, they're rare states and hard to do the power spectrum because they are so weak. Very high state, once again, that power law tail pops up back again, but this time with a 2.5 index. The variability pops back up again, not quite as strong as the low state. Instead of 30-40%, this is 15-25% variability. It tends to be flat with a break between 1 to 10 hertz and then rolls off to an f to the minus 2. Although sometimes you see flat, roll off f to the minus 2, flat, roll off f to the minus 2. There can be some complications in the very high state, but usually less variability. And here is an example of Cygnus X1 in a low hard state. It's pretty much what I said. It's flat, the break at low frequency, f to the minus 1, and sort of a gentle rollover into an f to the minus 1.6 over here. Now, to show you further evidence that the Cygnus X1 high state does not look like a classic high or very high state, here is the power spectrum for the Cygnus X1 high state. You can see it also sort of has a power law dependence with a rollover. Variability range from 15 to 25%, so more variable than the typical, more variable than like a very high state. And I said 300 eV temperature instead of 1 kV temperature. Pardon?
Where does it come up?
This is power spectral density. Variability. Variability. So I'll come back to this.
What was on the bottom?
We'll come back to that later. No, I'm hiding that for now. I haven't defined what that is yet. GX339 minus 4 in its low hard state. Once again, it's sort of got that rough shape of flat f to the minus 1, f to the minus 2, or thereabouts. This particular case, there's a QPO sneaking out there. I won't talk anything about QPOs. Now, the one thing that you might see in some of these cases, and we see it in Cygnus X1, going back to this picture here where we have the power spectrum, the tail down here, which is sort of a minus 1.6, 1.7, we can do this in various different energy bands. This is the lowest energy band we could do the data in. If I split the data up into five different energy channels, so you can get this both on the same time here. This end of the curve, if I look at it for different energy bands, it flattens out as I go to higher energy for Cygnus X1. So it's minus 1.8 at 4 keV. I go up to 20 keV, it's now minus 1.4. That slope you see there roughly goes at the logarithm of the energy bands. So this is flattening out with increasing energy in the system.
And we see a theoretical interpretation creeping
in
as well.
We'll come to that. Well, I don't have a good theoretical interpretation, but it's a piece of observational data that has to be explained. There are theoretical implications of Compton clouds that come in here, which are not borne out by the data exactly. So just throwing out lots of observational facts that everybody has to explain if they want to come up with a model of this. Now, the other thing that we can do is not only worry about the absolute power in the light curve, but look at differences. As I said, we just talked about taking light curves in more than one energy channel. So we can take our total light curve and, say, break it up into a soft energy light curve and a hard energy light curve. And I can do a Fourier transform for each of these light curves. And if I do the Fourier transform for each of these light curves and then cross-correlate it in Fourier space, so I just multiply the Fourier transform of one times the Fourier transform of the other, I get something that has an amplitude and a complex phase. The Fourier transform, of course, is a complex quantity. So the phase of that cross-power spectral density, as it's called, is called the phase difference between the soft and the hard light curve. I can change that into a time lag at a given Fourier frequency just by dividing by 2 pi f, where f is the Fourier frequency. So what does this mean? What do I expect? Now imagine if I had, say, some source which emitted soft photons, and I see that those soft photons, and then that source propagates its information to some response at a distance r away that then emits hard photons with some propagation speed cp here. Then if I take the Fourier transform of the soft light curve and the hard light curve and cross-correlate them, what I would expect to get would be a Fourier time lag, which is just equal to the distance divided by the speed, which would be a constant at all Fourier frequencies. You're shaking your head, Bob. You're at infinity, Bob. Let's pretend you're at infinity. The naive expectation is that if there's just a propagation going on at a constant speed.
That propagation is much less than the speed of light.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah. As long as that propagation is much less than the speed of light, then you expect the time delay to be constant at all Fourier frequencies and the radius divided by the speed of sound. And this will come into play in a little bit. Is that anywhere close to the truth in these systems? And the answer is no. What you see here is the time.
So where does the difference in energy of the photons come in? So this is just a time lag at a single frequency.
At a single frequency between two different energy bands. So that's, say that's 4 keV, and say this is 15 keV. Fourier transform each one, do the cross correlation between a low energy band and a high energy band. What's the time difference between the average time difference between the variability in these bands at a given Fourier frequency?
But do you have to identify individual peaks?
No. But the way it works is basically I
I do it in a statistical sense. I take my light curve and I slice it up into bins. Each bin is 256 seconds long. Do it in power of 2 because Fourier transforms are easy with powers of 2. So I do a cross correlation here. And then I do a cross correlation here, and I do a cross correlation here.
And I
I average those up. And I stack them up, and then I get some statistical average.
But there must be an inherent uncertainty in that at one wavelength you may be more variable than another, so it may be more difficult to determine a typical, you know, what's a peak and what's not a peak.
Well, he doesn't care about that. He just does some analysis of the whole
data stream. Yeah, you do the whole data stream. The only thing that's going to come in is Poisson noise. And Poisson noise has very well-defined statistical properties in Fourier space. So you can actually subtract out the Poisson noise, or at least know when it's creeping in. So you're right, there are some inherent uncertainties, but you know what they are, more or less. And as long as you have a statistically stationary process, no problem, you can do this. And you can at least say when the Poisson noise comes in. And basically, that's what you do. And I won't be showing you. I will show you some noise curve where the noise comes in for some curves coming up. So coming back to the question, is this near a constant time lag? And the answer is no. Here's the time lag for average of about 20 keV versus about 3 keV photons. What we see for Cygnus X1 and essentially all low slash hard state black hole candidates is that the hard photons arrive after the soft photons. Hard photons come second. All right, you might say that naively that makes sense. The idea if we have comptonization going on, the hard photons have to scatter more through the Compton cloud. So sure, they should be delayed a little bit. However, you see there's a fairly large dynamic range in time delays. And that time delay is Fourier frequency dependent. The faster the variability, the shorter the delay between hard and soft photons, with a delay going from about a millisecond at 30 hertz to about a tenth of a second at 0.1 hertz or so. And a tenth of a second for these kind of systems might as well be an eternity, because it's a very, very long time compared to light crossing times if it's a small corona. And this would be a constant time delay between all Fourier frequencies. What you see instead is something that is more or less going 1 over frequency. That's more like a constant phase delay in Fourier space. So the Fourier phase is closer to being constant between the two as opposed to the actual time lag. And here's another shot of that data explaining a little bit more how this is being done. To answer Peter's question, here are two light curves, the same energy bands as I just showed. As I said, you break it up into sections. I do a Fourier transform here, do a Fourier transform here, do the cross correlation. The phase of this in Fourier space might be sort of randomly dancing around. The phase of this in Fourier space might be randomly dancing around, but the cross correlation between the two, you can see, is staying more or less the same direction. So I have a statistically very well-defined function, and there is a constant, as a function of frequency, more or less phase delay between the two. Now, what does a constant phase lag translate to? Well, we know what a constant time lag translates to. That's just the distance with the propagation speed. Constant phase lag is slightly different. The fact that there is a phase lag at all that's well defined means that there's some linear transfer function from the variability in one band to the variability in the other band. And that transfer function in this case is more or less defined by that there is a constant amplitude between the two, but there's a phase difference between the two. If I want to translate this constant phase lag, more or less, between the two bands into an equivalent linear transfer function, what it's saying is that my hard photons and my soft photons, most of them come out exactly on top of each other. There's a delta function transfer. Soft and hard are exactly simultaneous. However, there's a small tail for the hard, that fraction being roughly the sine of the phase angle. The phase in this case was about 0.1 radians, so say 10%. 10% of the hard photons are coming out with a 1 over T tail. So hard and soft are mostly right on top of each other, and then there's a little bit, say 10% of the hard photon variability lags behind with a 1 over T transfer function.
No, because it's not as simple. I wish it were as simple as that.
Couldn't you just take your data and estimate AOT statistically?
This is not a unique model. You could do it. It'd probably be fairly noisy. I'm just throwing this out to give you some...
But that's an example.
As an example that gives you a constant phase, which looks kind of close to the truth as far as what you're seeing. Just to give you... Because, you know, you have an intuitive feel of what constant time lag means. This is to give you more of an intuitive feel of what constant phase lag could mean. I think it's somewhat close to what's going on in the data. Now, the one last bit of
you're not going to tell us about the 2D wave propagation?
Yes, I will.
I will. I'll get to that later. I just have to give you one more last piece of observational data that you have to understand here. I'll come back to Bob's question for the time lags. Soft state to hard state, you want to know it? Ignore this for now. Here's the time lags for the soft state of Cygnus X1. In the transition from hard to soft, and then soft back to hard for Cygnus X1, a little hard to see, the time lags average over the 1 to 10 hertz frequency bins drops. So time lags get shorter for Cygnus X1 when it goes to a soft state. So for people who want to make, if you want to think that somehow the time lags are related to the size of a corona, people who want to do models of the corona, thinking that maybe the size of the corona is actually changing. For this is an article.
484.
Yeah, page 383. 383, yeah. So there's one more piece of data on that, and this is the last thing you have to learn about Fourier transforms in these times. This is the coherence function. Now this is something, a little bit of a bugaboo that Brian Vaughn and I got started a few years ago. I'm not sure if we've been forgiven for it yet. Once again, we're taking finite Fourier transforms. We have two light curves, soft and hard, and we're doing cross-correlation between the two. The cross-correlation essentially is going to give us a complex vector at a given Fourier frequency for each one of these times. And that complex, the angle of that complex vector is the phase lag, which we can translate into a time lag. Nothing says that they have to be the same direction at a given Fourier frequency each time I do a slice. In fact, there's this measure called the coherence function, which is a measure of how close they are to being at the same direction for each slice I do. So it's essentially take the cross correlation, average it and square it, and divide through by the power spectrum of the soft and the power spectrum of the hard. And that gives me a measure of how much these are staying in the same direction as a function of my averaging process. And I said there's no reason why they have to be the same. So there's the two extreme possibilities that you can get. One is unity coherence, and one is small coherence. And here are these arrows represent my averaging process for the cross-correlation. If each time I do that cross-correlation for each slice of the light curve, the Fourier transform is in the same direction in the complex plane, I add them up, I'll get unity coherence, which is what's essentially saying is that the transfer function from soft to hard is not changing as a function of time along the light. Shaking your head, Bob.
There is some information in the amplitude of the coherence, too. The amplitude of the cross-correlation signal, right?
This is saying how...
This is different. This is whether it keeps pointing the same way.
But it's also...
What about the amplitude?
Yeah, this is not...
The length of the vector.
This does not give information about the amplitude. You're right. It's mostly the direction of the vector. Yeah, it is. You want a fourth function here.
Well,
you're right. There should be... This does involve the amplitude to some degree.
Yeah, every bin you get an amplitude.
And a direction.
Right.
And
you can extract that.
Right.
Well, there isn't there a thing you could do.
You've got a vector in every time bin. There are an infinite number of things.
Right? Well, there's always, I'm sure someone will do it.
How many bins are we talking about?
100, 200 or so. 200. Individual slices, and then, you know, in that 100 different frequencies, so, you know, talking 2,000 or thereabouts. The other option, of course, is that the direction could be changing, which is saying my transfer function from soft to hard is somehow changing. And then you'll get less than unity coherence. And you'll also get a net phase lag, which can be different. Now, what do you expect in reality? Well, a point source with a linear response, there's a one-to-one correspondence between source and response. In that case, I expect perfect coherence. Or if I have multiple unresolved sources going through a uniform response, like these are my soft sources here, and I'm seeing that light curve, and they're going through some response and creating the hard light curve, in that case, I also expect unity coherence. When do I expect non-unity coherence? Well, a simple example would be any nonlinear transfer function. Say I have some soft light curve and my hard light curve response is just to take my soft light curve and square it. In that case, I'm taking power, this is a very simple example, I'm taking power from frequency f and shifting it to frequency 2f. You know, imagine this is a sine wave and this is sine squared. Sine squared is cosine 2 theta, so I'm taking power from f to 2f. In general, any nonlinear transfer function, this is something the electrical engineers knew 50 years ago, a nonlinear transfer function in general takes power from f and transfers it to harmonics of f. In that case, coherence is destroyed. So one example of, say, a nonlinear transfer function, what if my light curve, what if I'm changing my temperature as a function of time, and I'm getting some simple black body emission from temperature changing as a function of time. In this case, you have a very nonlinear transfer function between soft and hard. And in that case, I would expect no coherence between the light curves. What about the things that we do play about? Compton clouds. If the Compton cloud is static, it is a coherent source. In the sense that I have some photons coming from a disk out here, they transfer through the Compton cloud and come out with some different energy. In that case, as long as this Compton cloud is static, there is a well-defined linear transfer from soft to hard. In that case, that should look coherent, which is another reason why people go like to go with Compton clouds.
What happens if the soft source were not out in the disk, but were mixed in with the cloud?
It could also be, in that case, coherent if it were happening in a regular repeating pattern and there was always a... As long as the soft source is not changing the structure of the corona, then it would still be linear and coherent.
Even if they
spurt
without soft photons at random
times,
at random positions?
That's fine. In that case, you might start expecting that the coherence to start deviating from unity. In that case, and it might be very, this is the odd thing to think that, you know, we have 40% variations going on here, so these are not just simple linear perturbations going on to the corona. These could be fairly robust, vigorous perturbations. And so that, what you're getting at is that you might expect coherence to drop away in any sort of reasonable model of these sources. And I agree with you. You would tend to expect that. As I said, anything that fluctuates the Compton cloud and changes its structure by any large degree will tend to wipe out coherence. Or likewise,
structure and temperature.
Size,
yeah, yeah.
Can changing. Temperature can be changing. That would do it. Or as you said, if I have a flare going off here, it's seeing a different path to scatter out than, say, a flare going off here. It's seeing it. So in that case...
Well, that may not be a huge effect. I mean, people have thought about this. You can think of expanding photons into normal modes.
Yeah.
They're sort of the slowest dying mode and the next slowest dying mode and so forth.
Right.
And the slowest dying mode is the one that gets hard, and all the others die away faster.
Yeah.
So there's probably a tendency to all the, wherever the soft photon source is, for all, most of the hard energy to show up in the lowest mode anyway.
Yeah. But you know, so, you know, if you're seeing the soft photons from here, this part of the corona, and at the same time seeing soft photons from over here, they're each going through different kinds of paths through the Compton cloud. So when I do this light curve, you're averaging them together, and then that's a case where you'll tend to drop the coherence a bit, because they're having different transfunctions that are being mixed. And so that could also lead to a loss of coherence. There's a lot of ways you can think of losing coherence. There's a lot of not as many ways as you can think of preserving coherence. And this is why it's an interesting statistic to play with it a little bit. And this is
now we show us the data. We're
yes.
Trying to see it.
That's what I'm going for. Yes. Okay. There you go.
This is Cygnus X1 in its low hard state, comparing 20 to 3 keV. Between, here you go, about 0.03 hertz and 10 hertz or so, it's more or less perfectly coherent. It's pretty darn good. You can see a slight drop here, and that's actually statistically significant, that drop. At high frequency, it's going down. At low frequency, it's going down. Both of those are also statistically significant. And as I was saying before, the only source you have to worry about is Poisson noise, but to put a technical spin on this, there is an optimal filter for removing the Poisson noise from this. This is a well-defined fourth-order statistic, and you can remove the Poisson noise from the process, so you can get very good statistics on this. So whatever process is going on, relating soft to hard variability, not only is there this time lag between soft and hard variability, but this time lag is very well defined, at least between 0.01 hertz and 10 hertz.
So you almost said, but how do you get the error bars?
It's a combination of the statistical fluctuations from how many things I'm stacking up, plus factoring in the Poisson noise. How much is the Poisson noise smearing out my ability to measure the coherence?
And they're sort of one sigma or something?
Yeah, it's sort of one sigma, yeah.
They look too conservative. I mean, you sort of see them all lined up nicely, despite the fact that the error bars are large.
Yeah, down, they might be a little bit conservative down here, but then again, we're also running into, you tend to run into systematic errors down here.
What about dead time correction?
This is where the dead time corrections also come in. You put in the dead time corrections changes the statistics of Poisson noise, but that can be accounted for, and it seems to work pretty well. The understanding of dead time in XT has to be fairly off, which we don't think it is, for this drop to go away. So this drop is real, and so this drop is real, and this fact that this drops over here like that is also real. And because the statistics are so good, you can actually make some pretty strong statements about what's going on. So another way of presenting this to you in the data is this plot here. What I've done is the comparison band is this 3 keV band, and here's the different energy bands that we've done this for, and this is the log of 1 minus the coherence function, whereas white is very coherent and dark is getting incoherent. So because I'm doing the log of 1 minus the coherence, I'm taking very sensitive measurements of small deviations from unity coherence. So by definition, any light curve is coherent with itself. And you can see here is the band from roughly 0.01 hertz to 10-ish hertz or 3 hertz or so, where it's fairly coherent. And as you see, as I go to higher energy bands comparing to the lowest energy band, the variability gets less and less coherent. If I go to higher frequency or lower frequency, once again, the coherence drops off on either end.
Do you mind if this was in low state?
This is all low hard state. However, you do see this odd thing going on here, where I get less and less and less coherent. I suddenly jump to 20 keV, I'm more coherent again. And because the statistics are so good, this is actually statistically significant.
Another question of just your bidding energy channels.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I could have chosen your bidding and energy channel
is different. Oh, yeah, I could have, certainly. But still the trend would probably be more or less the same, that you know, this is, you know, why did this drop and then come back? I don't know. And that's actually significant. But I said, this is the observational fact that you have to explain, that more or less from here to here, it's fairly coherent, and then at high frequency it rolls off. And at low frequency it also rolls off.
And come back to that last bit of data that Bob wanted to see. This is, once again, going to now the soft state of Cygnus X1, averaging the coherence in 1 to 10 hertz bands. In the transition, the coherence is slightly lower from hard to soft, and soft to hard, the coherence drops. But once you get back into the soft state, you're more or less coherent. So hard state up here, which is the previous data, you're coherent. Transition, the coherence drops. Comes back when you're in the soft state, and then goes away as you go soft to hard, then comes back when you're over here in the hard state. So there are actually changes that are going on.
mentioned something about propagation and oscillation.
We're getting there. We're getting there. Almost there. Just the we're almost getting to the modeling section part. All right. So a few comments on the coherence of Cygnus X1. The unity coherence implies a linear response and possibly a single response. Question: does this argue against Apache Corona? The low frequency rollover is real. Is that lost due to the fact that we have multiple soft sources that we're seeing at low frequency? The high frequency rollover is also real. Maybe there's a little bit of Poisson noise sinking in there, but not much, I think. And this could be that we're seeing the dynamical time scales of the flares feeding the corona. You can imagine that any flaring going on in the corona is going to be a highly nonlinear event. It's not going to be a simple transfer function for flares feeding a corona. I think maybe that's what's causing that high frequency rollover at 10 hertz or so. That's saying where the physics of the situation is becoming nonlinear. And I don't think that would surprise too many people if that were true. So, now here's some of the models that people have used to explain this. Now, here's what we expect from compensation, from real simple compensation. In simple compensation, the change in the photon energy, the fractional change, is just going as 4kT over mc squared. So the log of the final energy to the initial energy of the photon due to scattering is going to be roughly the number of scatters times 4kT over mc squared. So if I have some number of scatters, what I expect, and the number of scatters from comparing two energy bands that have been comptonized, and if the only difference in energy is due to comptonization, is going to be mc squared over 4kT. Roughly 2 to 3 for the kind of parameters we're thinking of. Say a 50 keV cloud, mc squared is 511 keV. The log of the ratio of the energies, typically we're comparing, say, a 20 keV band to a 2 keV band. So the number of differences in scatters for a photon that you're observing at 2 keV versus a photon you're observing at 20 keV is on the order of 4 to 6 or so. Now, what's the time per scatter? The time per scatter is just going to go as the radius of the corona divided by the speed of light, if it's optically thin corona. Or it's going to go as the radius divided by the speed of light divided by the optical depth, if it's an optically thick corona. Now, the idea, if it's an optically thin corona, it's always scattering on less than the mean free path. So it's going to be on the more or less the largest path like it can scatter on, which is the radius of the corona. The thing you have to keep in mind is that when you're doing these observations, you're fixing the observed output band and you're fixing the observed input band. Therefore, you're fixing the number of scatters if it's a compensation model. The average number of scatters might go as tau squared, but by the fact that you're choosing your energy bands to look at, you're choosing the number of scatters that you're looking at in a compensation model.
Now, that's the mean value, right?
That's
really a big spread.
There is a spread about that value, which is roughly going to go as the square root of n, more or less. It actually, if you work through it, it's going to be like that. And what that spread will tend to do is that if I have some delta function input for the variability, the fact that I have some spread is going to tend to smear out that variability. So any frequency variability in the source that gets scattered through won't be quite so sharp on the way out. So what you tend to expect is something of an exponential rollover at high frequency in the power spectrum.
When you approach a Poisson distribution on the basis of experiments of throwing a coin, usually it takes a huge amount of time until you establish the distribution. So if you did a Monte Carlo simulation of the same thing, if you do 1,000 or 10,000 throws, then you get the square root of n to square root. But initially, if you only are talking of 10 or 100 throws, you get a broader.
Yeah, you absolutely would. But remember here, when we're doing the light curves, we're taking this 20,000, 30,000 second light curve, and we're slicing it up into 200 seconds at a time, say. So we do have our 1,000 experiments in the light curve. On top of that, what we do is we tend to average frequencies a little bit, too.
you know, very near by frequency bins. So you do get these very large number statistics in doing the power spectrum. So you do approach something which is statistically well distributed. But yeah, that's a perfectly valid point. The thing is, like the coherence function, between any two light curves, if I just take one, is by definition unity, because there's always going to be a transfer function between one and the other. It only starts dropping away from unity once I start averaging up a number of them together. And likewise, I have to average some significant number together of the power spectra and possibly over frequencies to make this well defined. But usually we have those statistics. And we, as I said, we have 20,000 seconds or so.
Just by looking at this purple plot of the coherence, you can see he has enough count to do what he's doing, just from that. The systematic features in that plot were stronger.
All right. So, I mean, so from this, the expectation for a simple Comptonization model, as we're saying, is that, all right, 4 to 6 scatters difference. If the radius of the corona is 30 RG or so, and its tensile mass is 1.5 milliseconds, I might expect something on the order of, you know, 9 or 10 milliseconds.
Wait a minute, where'd you get 30 RG from?
I'm picking the number.
Why? You're making a statement at your last line. Is that saying?
If the corona is on this size,
you expect that.
Well, that is the whole point. No. But that's exactly the point. That what you see is that you've got things that are much longer than that.
Yeah.
And that's the observational problem. That's exact. I'm just sort of giving the expectation of what people thought and hoped that they would see.
Historical comments.
Yeah. And the expected time delays is that. And, you know, going back to, in history, this field is sort of the same thing as for us who work on waves. If you sort of look long and hard enough, you find that probably Soji Kato wrote the paper first 20 years ago. Likewise, in this, it's Miyamoto. If you look long and hard enough, you realize he thought of this a long time ago. And this is, I don't have a copy of this paper, but he specifically mentions this problem. That they saw this with Ginga, and you expect, you know, a few millisecond time delays, but they go up to on the orders of 0.1 seconds, so this is inconsistent with inverse Compton scattering model of Cygnus X1. So the idea being that not only do you expect a small time delay, but you expect it to be constant overall Fourier frequency. One suggestion that was thrown out by Cole Miller back in 1995 was to say, all right, maybe it's not the corona creating the time delays. Maybe the time delays are intrinsic to the disk. And what we're doing here is saying, all right, let there be some shots going off inside the corona that have their own time delays. And then they just get scattered through the corona and reprocessed by the corona. So what you expect to see in that case is that you expect to see some convolution of the intrinsic time delays in whatever your flares are going off, convolved with the scattering through the Compton cloud, which is going to give you that effect of flattening out to this few milliseconds at high frequency. And here were some simple simulations of that, comparing 2 to 4 keV versus 8 to 12 keV, that depending upon how soft your input was going to determine whether you saw more of the corona versus more of what's the intrinsic time delays. And the idea, the softer your input, the more the corona affects it and the more of that shelf that you expect to see. And so we actually did this with the data, and Brian Vaughn and I went back and did that paper slightly more carefully. If you put the time lengths in a disk and you pass it through a corona with various different size of radii, basically what we found is that more or less, if the corona is anything bigger than 30 or so g over c squared, the corona takes over completely, wipes out any intrinsic time delays in the disk. And that was the general conclusion of the paper. And this was assuming the most optimistic case. We put in the maximum allowed possible time delay between the energy bands and the soft input. By definition, you can't have a phase lag greater than pi, because then it's cyclic, it just wraps around on itself again. So we put in that maximum possible phase lag, and even that maximum possible phase lag for any corona bigger than about 30 g over c squared will be completely wiped out, and the corona dominates the time lags.
Mike, forgive a simple-minded question.
Yeah.
If I follow Paul here,
I thought the claim was that you were expecting very short time scale delays in corona.
For 30.
That was a historical comment.
That was a historical comment.
All right.
And
the 10 milliseconds was for what is now an obsolete.
Well, maybe
it's
the real corona.
Small. Yeah. But I'm just saying, it's hard to put it in the disk and make it survive.
I understand why you're saying that the corona produced small time delays, then I don't see how it would erase longer time delays that were built into the.
Yeah, but the problem is, draw the quick sketch here. I've got some input A and some input B going into some output 1 and some output 2, where these are my input energy bands and my output energy bands. The thing problem is that A gets scattered into 1, B also gets scattered into 1, likewise A gets scattered into 2, and B also gets scattered into 2. So you have phase information from both being scattered into your output bands as well. The question is, what's the asymmetry in the scattering process? And that asymmetry, if the temperature of the input is much, much less than the energy bands of the output, this asymmetry is very, very small. So you tend to get, even though these have intrinsically large phase differences, I'm seeing roughly an equal proportion of both in my output bands, and so the net phase difference in the output bands is very, very small, even though the phase difference here can be very, very large. And that becomes more true depending upon the temperature input.
A and B are spatially distinct?
That would be the only way of saving it. A and B would have to be spatially distinct. But they'd have to be giving a lot of power both to it, and that's hard to imagine a way to do it. They'd have to be very spatially distinct, because light travel times are very fast. You can sort of.
This is all assuming an optically thick.
No, it also is true for optically thick as well.
But that changes the time scale because it's more scattered.
Yeah, and plus, but it also shrinks the scattering path length. It gets a little bit complicated, but the basic statement is still true, that the bigger the corona, the more they're wiped out. And very large differences can be wiped out. As I said, it's mostly a function of how low below my output energy bands is my input energy bands. And for most realistic coronas, corona is going to dominate whatever you put into it, just because, as I said, it's more or less a symmetric process, as this energy gets much lower than the output energy. So in the sense, what that's saying is, no matter what you think of, whatever's changing the energy into hard photons, that's where the time lags are coming from. They're not in the disk. They're in the corona, whatever that substance is. And that's more or less the moral of that story. So
up there, you know, we assume that the time lags were done somewhere in the source of soft photons.
Yes. Yes. We took a realistic source of soft photons of about 150 EV, and we broke that up into various energy bands, and between the lowest and the highest, we put in a maximum phase lag we couldn't think of, and then passed it through a corona that fit the data for Cygnus X1, and the corona, as you can see, the corona was anything bigger than 30, it just wiped it out. And you can see that shelf gets higher and higher depending upon the size of the corona.
So you've got to talk about waves from A to B, which will give a timeline too.
That, well, very phenomenologically, we'll get in there. Here's the other interesting bit of data, which sort of forces, this is the real key of what's forcing people to think about, or making people think about coronae possibly being very, very big, that the number of scatters I expect is going as the log of the ratio of the energies. Well, does the data show that? And the answer is yes. Here is at 10 hertz, 1 hertz, and 0.3 hertz, here's the time delays that I'm measuring in each of those frequencies for four energy bands compared to an energy band down here, and they fit a log of energy ratio data very nicely. So that's what's making people think maybe there really is compensation causing the time delays. However, the other thing that you should notice is that not only is this log energy dependence here, But the coefficient out here, mc squared 4kt, and don't forget, if I want to change this to a time lag, there's an r over c here as well. That coefficient is frequency dependent. So we're scratching our heads and saying, what's going on here? Does that mean that the radius is in itself somehow frequency dependent as a function?
Does it work out the thing that the larger radius, the lower temperature?
The explanation there, what do you mean? I'm not sure by lower temperature.
Well, you're saying that the temperature depends on
that's,
the
size. That's another, I'm saying the number of scatters is going as this. If I want to turn it to a time lag, I also have to multiply by a radius. So either I have to increase the radius for lower frequency, or, as you rightly said, you could decrease the temperature as a function of frequency as well. That would do it as well. Either way.
Well, you wouldn't get stung if you had a large corona with a uniform temperature. So, you would expect some gradient of temperature, and you would expect the gradient to be negative.
Well, this would be dependent on frequency.
You have to think of some way of different temperatures and different radii filtering out a specific frequency. And that's the tricky part.
A radius is not enough.
That somehow there has to be a frequency dependence built into that. And as I said, this really is the data, which is very believable, that makes you think maybe there really is something going on with that's intimately related to compensation. As I said, that's 4 NG bands, and maybe I could have pushed that to a
corona, you need not have a corona which is just a homogeneous blob. You could have something like, a funnel, which is in the wall of the corona, and then you could have compensation, from stuff that scatters at different heights and different radii on the funnel.
That's a possibility too.
Then you have a natural.
Yeah.
Down there you have a higher temperature, and up there lower temperature, and the distance is different here than there.
Yeah. No, I agree. That's something that, and if you start thinking that in, at least for GH329-4, we also see radio emission, which we know is coming from some sort of outflow, it might be natural to think that the corona that's doing this is the base of that outflow. And so I agree, that's a very reasonable model that really has to be set down and done, and hopefully we'll get to that while I'm still here. That's a perfectly natural model, has not been looked at yet, and definitely should be. And I think that might save some of this with throwing in the fact that the temperature could be changing as a function of height, and probably is changing as a function of height. But I'll give you the Kazanis-Wass-Tarchuk solution to this. And their solution was to take the opposite approach in some sense and fix KT as a constant and make a very large radius corona on the order of 10 to the 4 GM over C squared.
KT is constant
over the whole thing. Yeah, that's the problem. That's really the problem. And the density is going as r to the minus 1. So roughly we have equal optical depth per decade in radius. So there's roughly equal probability for a photon scattering over any decade of radius. So the interesting thing about this reproduces both the power spectrum density and the lags. Because it's static, the coherence is 1. There's no problem with that. But what happens essentially is that if I have some source of variability in the center of say the soft photons varying, any photons that go out and scatter on large radius will take very large path length changes. What will happen is that because they're scattering over large radius, and this idea that we're talking about before, that there's some deviation in the number of scatters or the path length of the scatters, that's going to tend to wipe out any high frequency variability associated with this. Anything that's varying very rapidly and scatters over such path lengths will be smeared out. So no high frequency variability will come from these photons that scatter over large radius.
Then I don't understand what's written on the slide. It says high. You mean no high effort?
Well, I'll get to this bit.
No, it says high effort.
Yeah, but look where there's a little arrow there. I'll talk about that in a second. So anyone who scatters on these large radii, their high frequency variability will be smeared out.
Yeah, sure.
And on top, because they've scattered over large radii, they'll have very long time lags between soft and hard. Likewise, anything that scatters on small radii, the high frequency variability survives. And because they're scattering over small scales, they have very short time lags between hard and soft. So what you naturally expect is that all high frequency variability is coming from in here, all low frequency variability is coming from out here, so there's a natural correlation between time lag and frequency of variability in this model.
Yeah, but I'm missing something. The high frequency variability photons then have to get out before we can observe them.
So yes, but it's rough. It's
so you're looking at a given energy band, so it's a given number of scatters.
No, but they have to get out without scattering. They're not going to get out.
Right. Yeah, but the thing is, because it's logarithmic, essentially equal tau per decade, the photons that you're seeing, more or less.
So it's cooked up so that they
just. It's cooked up, yeah, so they can't escape.
Okay. Did they or anybody else ask a more general question? They assume the point model, T is constant and goes like R to the minus 1. Did they try taking T goes to some power law and goes to some other power law and see if they could get it working?
They have not changed power laws in T. They have changed power laws in density.
Their code can't do it yet. Right?
Yeah. And the big problem that you'll notice with that is that, you know, take NKT times R squared, all the energy is living out at large radius at 10 to the 4. That's very, very odd.
Yeah, right.
However, you know, with those caveats in mind, there's no conservation of energy.
Of course.
Small detail.
Small detail. Yeah. But it more or less, I don't have a positive PSD, unfortunately, it more or less fits the general outline of the PSD, it fits the spectral data, and it reproduces the timelines. So this is the Miyamoto time lags, I think, that Miyamoto was talking about from 1988. XTE time lags, XTE spectral data, and PSD, it fits all of them simultaneously.
This just shows that if you take an artificial enough model, you can fit in the data.
Yeah. True, but as I said, their main motivation in doing this is trying to really explain that. And that's a key piece of information, which is somehow telling us something. I agree. I think it's an artificial model.
Yeah, we should not laugh at it. We should try to.
But as I said, I think probably the most realistic way to improve it is along the lines that you suggested, is that don't make it a 10 to the 4 corona, make it an outflow. Don't just change the radius, but also change the temperature. And that's a very natural thing to start thinking about. And I said, and there's reason with the radio data to think that there is this outflow there. So, I mean, I think that's probably the direction that the approach should go. And the other question that we asked is, there's another big problem with this. I also briefly mentioned that Marcus Becher and Ed Liang have a variation on this where they have a very large 10 to the 4 corona and they're sending cold blobs through it. And they're saying that this fits the data better. They have an ampere letter on it. Unfortunately, the ampere letter just basically says, well, cold blobs going through the corona, it fits the data, but we won't show you any of the data.
The point is, instead of temperature, we now have bulk motion of the cold blobs.
Bulk motion of the cold blobs. And the paper actually is published, but with actually no calculations or details. They're saying, you know, the details will be coming in a full paper, but we'll publish the letter first. The other problem with the Kazanis-Wang-Tatarchuk model is that it assumes isotropic photons. It doesn't matter whether it's isotropic in the center or isotropic at coming out from the outside of it. But if you want to put a disk in there, which you might say is suggested by the data because it's 150 EV, and if the soft photons are coming from the disk, in order for the soft photons to first see this small scattering region in the center, they have to scatter once on the largest radii. And that's going to then make the corona take over with the longest time lags. So in that case, what we get is like this, that if the soft photons are coming from a disk, then once again we're back to this constant time lag, and their model is wiped out. So it's very much saying that not only does it have to be this big corona, 10 to the 4 g over c squared, but it has to be isotropic photons. And that's also a big problem, I think, for the model. Yes.
The main problem for this model is some kind of physical problem.
Yeah, it's also, it's not, I agree.
In this sense, you know, it's, yeah, I mean, Maybe you can draw some information.
Yeah, but it's also saying even if they wanted to say play with changing the temperature and radial structure and actually make it but the isotropic part still is holding true.
Yeah, as you say, that's a separate issue.
Yeah, so there are two separate. So even if you want to save it somehow by changing the temperature structure, you have to still make it isotropic protons. Yes.
Carbon is 10 to the 4 RG, right?
Yeah.
Also, disk photons come out of 30.
Oh, yeah, if you want to put the disk inside the corona, you can do it, then it's an isotropic source. Yeah, you're going to do, yes. Yeah, you can have a huge, you can have a huge corona and a tiny disk on the inside. That's fine.
Yeah, you don't have to have a disk at all. I don't think it signals X a lot. I mean, people are written papers about
that.
It's sort of trembling on the edge of being between a wind accretor and a disk accretor. And if you just sort of go through the simple estimate of how big the disk might be, you know, based on the supergiant wind velocity and all that kind of thing. You find that either there's a pretty small disk there, not a large disk, and people have speculated that maybe in those cases there isn't a cold disk there at all.
As I said, you can. It's
very interesting.
So the cold disk is not a necessary feature of Cygnus X.
Yeah.
Which is funny if you remember that the first fully relativistic disk model was done by Novikov and for Cygnus X.
As I said, also historically, you know, the high state was defined for Cygnus X1, but it's perhaps the poorest example of what's become known as the high state.
You still have to tell us about your observations.
Just a question about the constant of temperature. I'm not completely convinced that it's non-physical, because they assume that the density is decreasing, and finally that the optical thickness per decade of radio stays the same. So it means that per decade they receive the same amount of seed photons, no? So.
Yeah, but I'm still worried about that n r squared nkt is going up with radius. So you're right. As far as the energy.
No.
You really can't do Compton heating because the Compton temperature of the power law in Cygnus X1 is on the order of 4 keV. So you. So Compton heating will. You turn off whatever. If you turn off the energy input to the corona, it's going to drop to 4 keV, and that's the big problem with it. So there has to be some external source actively heating the corona wherever it's hot. Yeah, it really does have to be that way. All right, coming to the propagation models, this has been suggested as a possibility for an ANF. As you said, an ANF is just a spherical corona with a disk outside. It's the same sort of concept. And Manmoto a few years ago, I think this is in 1994, suggested, all right, we'll take an ANF and we'll put a big perturbation on the outside and let it propagate on the way inward. And this is some pictures of his plot where he basically puts a perturbation, you see it propagates inwards, hits the inner edge of the disk, steepens to a shock, and then propagates outwards. And does cause a modulation, at least in this case, the thermal Bremsstrahlung component, that looks like a shot in Cygnus X1 where it sort of goes up and it comes down. Problems with this is that, one, it's thermal Bremsstrahlung. If you see the numbers here, the luminosity is 10 to the 34 that he's talking about, when really Cygnus X1 is 10 to the 37, 10 to the 38. The time delays are still very fast. This thing is being invected in, more or less, at the free fall speed. So this whole shot comes in and comes out on roughly 0.1 second time scales. And the time delay between hard and soft are going to be shorter still. So although it's an interesting concept, it's still not quite developed yet for an advection-dominant model.
Yeah, I would add that you wouldn't have a standard episteme quake in an ADA. So it's kind of...
Yeah.
You have to be careful.
And also the thing to worry about is that if the wave comes in and shocks over here and then develops into a shock, this is essentially going to mean that this is a now a nonlinear transfer function. So how much does that destroy the coherence that you see in Cygnus X1? However, this concept of waves in a disk is not such a bad idea, I think, because it does have qualitatively some of the features of the time delays that you see in Cygnus X1 and other models. And so, you know, the idea that if it's a 2D wave, 2D waves don't obey Huygens' principle. The idea in 3D, you send in a delta function, it propagates with some time r over c, and it propagates as a delta function if there's no dispersion in the medium. However, even in a medium with no intrinsic dispersion in 2D, I send in a delta function, it propagates as a step function with a 1 over square root of t tail. This doesn't seem too dissimilar from the 1 over t tail we talked about for the constant phase lag situation. Okay. I'll just sneak in and write. Yeah, okay. So 2D waves do not obey Huygens principle. So 2D, if it's a two-dimensional kind of wave propagation, naturally you have something that fits into that mold. So this is just very, very phenomenological, no physics to it at all, just to see what kind of time scales we need to play with it. Let's take a 2D wave situation where we postulate that I'm sending in 2D waves from the outside, there's some response in the soft, and then some response in the hard, and just that the hard comes from smaller radii than the soft. And that's all we're doing, and which might seem very natural that it's hotter as you go closer in. If you do that, you can sort of fit the rough shape of, in this case, the phase lags. The only caveat is that you need fairly slow propagation speeds to make this work out. The propagation speeds are somewhere on the order of 1% the speed of light to 0.1 the speed of light. No, just imagine just propagating everything as 2D waves.
2D waves.
2D waves going through a cylindrically symmetric medium.
And some outer radius.
And some outer radius in this case, take 100 gm over c squared. The smaller I make this, or the closer I put these two together, the slower the propagation speeds I need. And I just did this to point out that even this is getting kind of, this is getting, you know, basically slower than the free fall speed. So it starts making it difficult in an ADF kind of model, unless you make the ADF radius very, very big, to get out the kind of time delays that you might need to see.
The concept of the glass component in a spherical, distant corona, and then you propagate through the...
Yeah, I'm assuming propagating through even the coronal region in a two-dimensional fashion. So, like, propagating through the mid-plane. Oh, it doesn't matter. No difference between the ADF and corona, it's just that you might, the ADF naturally says that your minimum speed is close to free fall.
Corona has slower speed, and it might vary with R.
Yeah, and you know, for efficient corona, this is also very slow compared to, say, a sound speed as well.
And so, I'm sorry, the slow propagation speed, then you have to substitute.
Oh yeah, this is a purely phenomenological model just to gauge what kind of speeds you need to make something like this work out. And the answer is slower than free fall, slower than sound speed, fairly slow for the kinds of things that we're thinking about.
And, you know, this with radial velocity
it
doesn't compare to
it's slower than it's comfortable.
What about
Yeah, diffusion speeds might work out.
It
could be. That's actually a possibility if you actually carefully thought about viscous diffusion. I think a diffusion speed would be the right speed to make it work out. And I think that's what it's. If it's a model like this, it's suggesting something on the order of diffusion speed, but not faster. As I said, I just throw that.
If you want to go back to hydrodynamic or hydromagnetic waves, there's going to be another complication, and that's they don't propagate at all freely in this disk because it's a shearing disk, and there are going to be Coriolis forces, co-rotation radii, and reflection radii, and all kinds of things.
So as I said, I think it's arguing for something along the lines of propagation and diffusion. Yeah. So I mean, I just throw that as something to think about. Now, once again, Miyamoto noticed this a long time ago, and that there were problems with quantization. So what he suggested is that what we have is that we have shots tending to occur with two preferred durations. The X-ray energy spectrum becomes harder as the shot progresses, and these shots could be clumps of matter in the disk that drift from the outer to the inner region of the disk before disappearing into the black hole. So I mean, he had this concept in mind for producing this sort of thing. Now, as far as the shots are concerned, one can take these peaks in the light, that you see in the Cygnus X1 light curve and stack the peaks up, and what you get is an average shot from, this is from Noguro, Miyamoto, and Kitamoto, and what you see is basically a somewhat exponentially rising, exponentially decaying shot, And the hardness ratio, when the shot happens, the light curve gets a little bit softer, and then it goes a little bit harder at the end, and then comes back down to what it used to be. And so that's what these shots kind of look like. More recently, Yuri Putan and Andy Fabian have suggested a different kind of model to do the time delays of Cygnus X1. And they suggest that what you have is a flat disk, and you're shooting flares off the disk. And the idea is that when the flare starts close to the surface, it's got a very low temperature. As it moves away, it keeps getting heated. It gets a higher temperature. It's now illuminating more of the disk, so it's heating the disk below it. Those soft photons are coming back and upscattering through the flare, and then as the flare keeps moving away, then starts getting cooler again. And this is basically the profile of the compactness of the flare as a function of time. And furthermore, if you have flares, what they postulate is that one flare goes off and then stimulates the production of another flare at some time further down. So it's like an avalanche model, a cascade model. And what the spectrum isn't a Compton corona at any given fixed temperature, but it's a sum of the spectrum of this flare as it gets hotter, 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 and then colder, 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 and you add it up from all the flares going off, and you get the total net spectrum of Cygnus X1. And because you're doing the statistics, and shot noise models have been around for a very long time. This is sort of a variation of the shot noise model that puts in a physical mechanism for the time delays by the fact that the flare is going away from the disk, and you have the Comptonization going on, and then you're generating subsequent flares. So they actually do produce the time delays. This is their fits to the data. They do get the power spectrum of flat f to the minus 1, roughly f to the minus 2. Any shot noise model can do that. That's not so terribly necessarily unique to the model. But on top of that, since they have a physical mechanism going on, they also produce the time delays. And they get time delays of roughly the right shape and the right order of magnitude as far as the time delays concerned, maybe a little bit not quite getting as high a time delay as they need, and they get roughly a log energy dependence to the time delays. However, what they don't get is that not only is there a log energy dependence, but there's that coefficient in front, which is frequency dependent. So they should have curves here that not only go up with energy, this is low energy, this is high energy, but tilt with energy. And you can see from their curves are not doing that. So they don't produce this. He doesn't say how he produces the iron line. And that's a very big question. He puts reflection in here, but I don't know if he puts it in by hand or if he does it self-consistently. And that's a major question for the model. It's very unclear in the paper whether the reflection they calculate is self-consistent. They calculate they're calculating a Comptonization, and then they're putting the reflection in afterwards. So you're right. You also think that you should produce an iron line unless you're moving these flares away very relativistically. But then if you're moving them away very relativistically, so you're beaming away, it's not clear whether you then get the time delays right. But that's a very important question for this model. So that's a major question that they do not answer in the paper. And as I said, they do not get that change in slope as a function of frequency, but they do get roughly the right shape and the right order of magnitude of the time delays. The other thing they don't get, because they're taking more or less all the shots are self-similar, they get near-perfect coherence as well. They don't get that rollover in coherence that you see at high frequency, which I really think that rollover in coherence is saying this is where the nonlinear physics of the flare mechanism is happening if it is flare. They pick a fiducial energy band, I think at 3 keV, and so... Yeah, comparison of I think this is 80 keV compared to that, and they don't quite get as high as you need, but you can get the PSD out of this. So it has some characteristics of the data. Okay, now let me throw out this other bit of stacking up shots like Nagoro did. And this is very interesting. I have no explanation for it, but I think it's telling us something. This is Feng Li and Chen, aptly impressed. They did the same idea as Nagoro, adding up shots and looking at the colors of the added shots. This here is more or less the answer that Nagoro got. But you can see in the transition states from low to high and high to low, there's dips, but when they're in the high state, the shot color is changed. It's qualitatively different. So I'm not sure what this is telling us, but I think it's definitely telling us something, that when you go to this high state, that the shots, instead of going soft then hard, go basically pretty much hard right away, then relax back down to soft. So there's a qualitatively different kind of shot in the high state. Another thing to throw out for you, this is Ford, Vanderklees, Mendez, and Van Paradijs. Black holes and neutron stars look very much the same. Here is Cygnus X1, 339-4, phase delays, coherences, and compare that to the neutron stars 1705 and 01614, phase delays and coherences, and they look kind of similar.
Yeah.
A little bit. So a little bit harder to do, I think, for the neutron stars. It's not, these have very high count rates and very long observations, so you can get good statistics here. So they say, well, maybe if this is a big corona, maybe there's a big corona both in neutron stars and black holes. What it's really saying is maybe the mechanisms are similar. All right, and can I get 10 minutes more? I'll just throw off enough with some data, which I think sort of poses questions for all of these. All right, never mind that. Never mind that. Here's GX339-4. We had 8 observations in its low hard state, so we actually need to do some comparisons as a function of energy. Couple things to notice here. One, lower luminosity, it gets harder. This is photon index or compactness parameter of a fit spherical corona model. Go to lower energy, the photon index decreases, so it's getting harder, or likewise, the compactness parameter increases. Both are saying the same thing. Lower luminosity, the source is harder. The other interesting thing to note, that in the low hard state, there is a radio source seen, and the radio luminosity is more or less roughly correlated with the BATSE luminosity and the XTE luminosity. So lower luminosity in the X-rays means lower luminosity in the radio, or higher luminosity in the X-rays means higher luminosity in the radio. So that's interesting thing one about it. If you want to say that the transition radius is changing for like an ADF type model in this low luminosity state, if the transition radius goes out with decreasing luminosity, it makes perfect sense that it gets harder. However, then the question is, what kind of outflow is coming from that? How should that be correlated? And the suggestion is here that the outflow is decreasing for if this is what's happening in this case. And so that's something to think about in the back of the mind. Once again, here is, I've shown you these before, that's the time lapse and the coherence function for GX3-4. The interesting thing, and I throw this out as a possible suggestion, here's the PSD for two states. Well, same state, low hard state, but two luminosities. This is the lowest luminosity observation we had. This was the highest luminosity observation that we had. You can see that this PSD can be reasonably well modeled by three components: the power law, a broad Lorentzian at low frequency, and a broad Lorentzian at high frequency. The thing that we see for low luminosity is that the frequency and the amplitude, the frequency goes down, the amplitude goes up when we drop to lower luminosity for this particular source. And here are the time lags at three different frequencies as a function of flux. So once again, this is low luminosity, this is high luminosity. There's a rough trend for time lags to decrease with flux. The trend is kind of ratty, so you don't necessarily have to believe that that trend is real, but the one thing that is real about this is that this PSD, which is lower frequency and higher amplitude than all other PSDs, has the shortest time lags associated with it. This tends to argue against the Patan-Fabian type of model where you have flares going off. In their model, the frequency, the time scale of the PSD is related to the time scale of the shots, but the time scale of the shots also gives you the time scale of the delay. So they need longer shots to get this low frequency PSD, which should also produce longer time delays. In this case, we have the lower frequency with shorter time delays, exactly opposite of the expectations of Poutin and Fabian type of models. As I said, you might not believe the trend, but this particular point for the lowest luminosity PSD has lower time delays than all the other, at all frequencies, than all the other observations, and it also has characteristically the lowest frequency PSD. So that tends to kind of argue against that kind of shot model, where the frequency of the PSD and the time scale are so intimately coupled.
Now, here's something cute we did with this, I think. This argues against the Kazanis-Wanta-Tarchuk type of model. I fit this with three components, as I said, power law and two Lorentzians. Let's pretend for a second that they're actually real, that each one of these three fit components actually means something physical to it. So what we can do is then, let's pretend that each of these components is real. It's coherent. Each component is coherent with itself and has its own phase lag with itself, but doesn't know about the phase lag of the other two components. So let's do that kind of model to it. So the net phase lag that I'm going to measure is going to be essentially a weighted sum of one component plus two components plus three components, so I get a net phase lag. And the coherence is going to be essentially what's the squared length of this compared to the squared length if they were all along in the same direction. That's essentially what the coherence function is. So now I can fit the PSD, the phase lags, and the coherence all together, and I can actually fit the phase lags fairly well, assuming constant phase lag between each one of these components. And where I see the PSD components overlapping in the fits, there's a little dip in the coherence. And this is true for all eight observations. So this is 1 minus the coherence. So where I see the two PSD components overlapping with roughly the same amplitude, I see a dip in the coherence. And likewise, I get a nice fit to the phase at the same time. So this is suggestive, well, not definitive proof of, that we really do have three separate coherent components going on simultaneously that don't know about each other in some sense. And in the Kazanis-Wanta-Tarchuk type models, there's one reprocessor. So there's only, you can only make one kind of component. This kind of data is tending to argue against that. I said you characteristically see these dips in the coherence where you see the fit components overlapping in the PSD.
And we might have one component is power law, your frequency, the other two components have frequencies of sort of a few hertz.
One is like a 0.1 hertz and one has a few 3 hertz. The interesting thing is that what I get is that the power law component essentially has no time lag with itself. The high frequency component has the longest time lag of all. And you can sort of see that because the phase rises for high frequency. And that's the weird thing about it. This has no, this power law, no time lag. And this is actually sort of, this is power law, high frequency, low frequency. I actually set the vectors to be roughly what you need to make the fit work out. And this is what it is, more or less. So I'll end off the whole talk with sort of a suggestion of maybe, things to think about, what could be going on. And this is sort of, I said, a sketch of the everybody is right kind of theory in one sense or another. The low state, we do have some sort of corona going on. Maybe we have red noise going off the disk. Let's get Compton scattered through with next to no time delay from the Comptonization. We could have cold blobs moving through on viscous timescales and possibly evaporating or being ionized as they move through, like Vetter and Liang wants. That could give you the kind of color curves that you expect. And on the fastest timescales, you've got flares feeding the corona. As I increase the luminosity, it somehow, for some reason, wants to collapse down into a classic Shakira Sanyaya disk. This does not last long as far as the luminosity changes are concerned. This is a very rare state. But if you ask, where does Shakira Sanyaya live? In the high state. And there's not many examples of those, but they are there. And then as I keep increasing the luminosity, it does go unstable, thermally and viscously, but you can stabilize those instabilities if I then take this disk and start blowing off a corona into it. So qualitatively, maybe you have something going on like this, but there's lots of physics going on here that we still have no clue about.
What about the very high state?
Going back to my 1915 is a very bizarre source. It's living at Eddington luminosity for 40 solar masses at times. And that's the strange thing about it. So it's got a huge luminosity output. It very possibly has a tremendous mass. And it does have, it has this occasional radio outflow. So no, 1915 does not live in this simple picture of the world. Nova Muscae might. Cygnus X1 might, 339 minus 4 might. I don't think 1915 is quite so simple. And I think I will stop at that and let us get lunch.